idiot I had been not to think of it before. I always loved the girl in white with a hat in her hand. It was a Raeburn, and the portrait was of Caroline de Winter, a sister of Maxim's great-great-grandfather. She married a great Whig politician and was a famous London beauty for many years, but this portrait was painted before that, when she was still unmarried. The white dress should be easy to copy, those puffed sleeves, the flounce, and the little bodice. The hat might be rather difficult, and I should have to wear a wig. My straight hair would never curl in that way. Perhaps that voce place in London that Mrs. Danvers had told me about would do the whole thing. I would send them a sketch of the portrait and tell them to copy it faithfully, sending my measurements. What a relief it was to have decided at last. Quite a weight off my mind. I began almost to look forward to the ball. Perhaps I should enjoy it after all, almost as much as little Clarice. I wrote to the shop in the morning, enclosing a sketch of the portrait, and I had a very favourable reply, full of honour at my esteemed order, and saying the work would be put in hand right away, and they would manage the wig as well. Clarice could hardly contain herself for excitement, and I too began to get party fever as the great day approached. Giles and Beatrice were coming for the night, but nobody else, thank heaven, although a lot of people were expected to dinner first. I had imagined we should have to hold a large house party for the occasion, but Maxim decided against it. Having the dance alone is quite enough effort, he said, and I wondered whether he did it for my sake alone, or whether a large crowd of people really bored him, as he said. I had heard so much of the Manderley parties in the old days, with people sleeping in bathrooms and on sofas because of the squash. And here we were, alone in the vast house, with only Beatrice and Giles to count as guests. The house began to wear a new expectant air. Men came to lay the floor for dancing in the great hall, and in the drawing-room some of the furniture was moved so that the long buffet tables could be placed against the wall. Lights were put up on the terrace, and in the rose garden too. Wherever one walked, there would be some sign of preparation for the ball. Workmen from the estate were everywhere, and Frank came to lunch nearly every day. The servants talked of nothing else, and Frith stalked about as though the whole of the evening would depend on him alone. Robert rather lost his head and kept forgetting things, napkins at lunch and handing vegetables. He wore a harassed expression, like someone who has got to catch a train. The dogs were miserable. Jasper trailed about the hall with his tail between his legs and nipped every workman on sight. He used to stand on the terrace, barking idiotically, and then dash madly to one corner of the lawn and eat grass in a sort of frenzy. Mrs. Danvers never obtruded herself, but I was aware of her continually. It was her voice I heard in the drawing-room when they came to put the tables. It was she who gave directions for the laying of the floor in the hall. Whenever I came upon the scene, she had always just disappeared. I would catch a glimpse of her skirt brushing the door, or hear the sound of her footsteps on the stairs. I was a lay figure, no use to man or beast. I used to stand about doing nothing except get in the way. "Excuse me, madam," I would hear a man say, just behind me, and he would pass with a smile of apology, carrying two chairs on his back, his face dripping with perspiration. "I'm awfully sorry," I would say, getting quickly to one side, and then, as a cover to my idleness, "Can I help you? What about putting those chairs in the library?" The man would look bewildered. "Mrs. Danvers' orders, madam, was that we were to take the chairs round to the back to be out of the way." "Oh," I said, "yes, of course, how silly of me. Take them round to the back, as she said." And I would walk quickly away, murmuring something about finding a piece of paper and a pencil, in a vain attempt to delude the man into thinking I was busy, while he went on across the hall, looking rather astonished, and I would feel I had not deceived him for a moment. The great day dawned misty and overcast, but the glass was high, and we had no fears. The mist was a good sign. It cleared about 11, as Maxim had foretold, and we had a glorious, still summer's day, without a cloud in the blue sky. All the morning the gardeners were bringing flowers into the house, the last of the white lilac, and great lupins, and delphiniums, 5 foot high, roses in hundreds, and every sort of lily. Mrs. Danvers showed herself at last, quietly, Calmly, she told the gardeners where to put the flowers, and she herself arranged them, stacking the vases with quick, deft fingers. I watched her in fascination, the way she did vase after vase, carrying them herself through the flower room to the drawing room and the various corners of the house, massing them in just the right numbers and profusion, putting colour where colour was needed, leaving the walls bare where severity paid. Maxim and I had lunch with Frank at his bachelor establishment, next door to the office, to be out of the way. We were all three in the rather hearty, cheerful humour of people after a funeral. We made pointless jokes about nothing at all, our minds eternally on the thought of the next few hours. I felt very much the same as I did the morning I was married, the same stifled feeling that I had gone too far now to turn back. The evening had got to be endured. Thank heaven Messrs. Voci had sent my dress in time. It looked perfect in its folds of tissue paper, and the wig was a triumph. I had tried it on after breakfast and was amazed at the transformation. I looked quite attractive, quite different altogether, not me at all. Someone much more interesting, more vivid and alive. Maxim and Frank kept asking me about my costume. You won't know me, I told them. You will both get the shock of your lives. You're not going to dress up as a clown, are you? Said Maxim gloomily. No frightful attempt to be funny. No, nothing like that, I said, full of importance. I wish you had kept to Alice in Wonderland, he said. Or Joan of Arc with your hair, said Frank shyly. I never thought of that, I said blankly, and Frank went rather pink. I'm sure we shall like whatever you wear, he said, in his most pompous, Frankish voice. Don't encourage her, Frank, said Maxim. She's so full of her precious disguise already, there's no holding her. Bee will put you in your place, that's one comfort. She'll soon tell you if she doesn't like your dress. Dear old Bee always looks just wrong on these occasions, bless her. I remember her once as Madame Pompadour, and she tripped up going into supper and her wig came adrift. I can't stand this damn thing, she said, in that blunt voice of hers, and chucked it on a chair and went through the rest of the evening with her own cropped hair. You can imagine what it looked like against a pale blue satin crinoline or whatever the dress was. Poor Giles did not cope that year. He came as a cook and sat about in the bar all night looking perfectly miserable. I think he felt Bee had let him down. No, it wasn't that, said Frank. He'd lost his front teeth trying out a new mare, don't you remember? And he was so shy about it he wouldn't open his mouth. Oh, was that it? Poor Giles. He generally enjoys dressing up. Beatrice says he loves playing charades, I said. She told me they always have charades at Christmas. I know, said Maxim. That's why I've never spent Christmas with her. Have some more asparagus, Mrs. de Winter, and another potato. No, really, Frank, I'm not hungry, thank you.
Nerves, said Maxim, shaking his head. Never mind. This time tomorrow it will all be over.
I sincerely hope so, said Frank, seriously. I was going to give orders that all cars should stand by for 5 a.m. I began to laugh weakly, the tears coming into my eyes. Oh, dear, I said. Let's send wires to everybody not to come.
Come on, be brave and face it, said Maxim. We need not give another one for years. Frank, I have an uneasy feeling we ought to be going up to the house. What do you think?
Frank agreed, and I followed them unwillingly, reluctant to leave the cramped, rather uncomfortable little dining room that was so typical of Frank's bachelor establishment, and which seemed to me today the embodiment of peace and quietude. When we came to the house, we found that the band had arrived, and were standing about in the hall, rather pink in the face and self-conscious, while Frith, more important than ever, offered refreshments. The band were to be our guests for the night, and after we had welcomed them and exchanged a few slightly obvious jokes proper to the occasion, the band were borne off to their quarters to be followed by a tour of the grounds. The afternoon dragged, like the last hour before a journey when one is packed up and keyed to departure, and I wandered from room to room, almost as lost as Jasper, who trailed reproachfully at my heels. There was nothing I could do to help, and it would have been wiser on my part to have kept clear of the house altogether and taken the dog and myself for a long walk. By the time I decided upon this, it was too late. Maxim and Frank were demanding tea, and when tea was over, Beatrice and Giles arrived. The evening had come upon us all too soon.
"This is like old times," said Beatrice, kissing Maxim and looking about her. "Congratulations to you for remembering every detail." "The flowers are exquisite," she added, turning to me. "Did you do them?"
"No," I said, rather ashamed. "Mrs. Danvers is responsible for everything."
"Oh, well, after all..."
Beatrice did not finish her sentence. She accepted a light for her cigarette from Frank, and once it was lit, she appeared to have forgotten what she was going to say.
"Have you got Mitchells to do the catering as usual?" asked Giles.
"Yes," said Maxim. "I don't think anything has been altered, has it, Frank? We had all the records down at the office. Nothing has been forgotten, and I don't think we've left anyone out."
"What a relief to find only ourselves," said Beatrice. "I remember once arriving about this time, and there were about 25 people in the place already, all going to stop the night."
"What's everyone going to wear? I suppose Maxim, as always, refuses to play."
"As always," said Maxim.
"Such a mistake, I think. The whole thing would go with a much more swing if you did."
"Have you ever known a ball at Manderley not to go with a swing?"
"No, my dear boy. The organisation is too good, but I do think the host ought to give the lead himself."
"I think it's quite enough if the hostess makes the effort," said Maxim. "Why should I make myself hot and uncomfortable and a damn fool into the bargain?"
"Oh, but that's absurd. There's no need to look a fool with your appearance, my dear Maxim. You could get away with any costume. You don't have to worry about your figure like poor Giles." "What is Giles going to wear tonight?" I asked. "Or is it a dead secret?"
"No, rather not," beamed Giles. "As a matter of fact, it's a pretty good effort. I got our local tailor to rig it up. I'm coming as an Arabian sheikh."
"Good God," said Maxim.
"It's not at all bad," said Beatrice warmly. "He stains his face, of course, and leaves off his glasses. The headdress is authentic. We borrowed it off a friend who used to live in the East, and the rest the tailor copied from some paper. Giles looks very well in it."
"What are you going to be, Mrs. Lacey?" said Frank.
"Oh, I'm afraid I haven't coped much," said Beatrice. "I've got some sort of Eastern get-up to go with Giles, but I don't pretend it's genuine. Strings of beads, you know, and a veil over my face."
"It sounds very nice," I said politely.
"Oh, it's not bad. Comfortable to wear, that's one blessing. I shall take off the veil if I get too hot. What are you wearing?"
"Don't ask her," said Maxim. "She won't tell any of us. There has never been such a secret. I believe she even wrote to London for it."
"My dear," said Beatrice, rather impressed, "don't say you've gone a bust and will put us all to shame. Mine's only homemade, you know."
"Don't worry," I said, laughing. "It's quite simple, really. But Maxim would tease me, and I've promised to give him the surprise of his life."
"Quite right, too," said Giles. "Maxim is too superior altogether. The fact is he's jealous, wishes he was dressing up like the rest of us, and doesn't like to say so."
"Heaven forbid," said Maxim.
"What are you doing, Crawley?" asked Giles.
Frank looked rather apologetic. "I've been so busy, I'm afraid, I've left things to the last moment. I hunted up an old pair of trousers last night and a striped football jersey and thought of putting a patch over one eye and coming as a pirate."
"Why on earth didn't you write to us and borrow a costume?" said Beatrice. "There's one of a Dutchman that Roger had last winter in Switzerland. Would have suited you excellently."
"I refuse to allow my agent to walk about as a Dutchman," said Maxim. "He'd never get rents out of anybody again. Let him stick to his pirate. It might frighten some of them."
"Anything less like a pirate," murmured Beatrice in my ear.
I pretended not to hear. Poor Frank. She was always rather down on him.
"How long will it take me to paint my face?" asked Giles.
2 hours at least," said Beatrice. "I shall begin thinking about it if I were you. How many shall we be at dinner?"
16, said Maxim, "counting ourselves. No strangers. You know them all."
"I'm beginning to get dress fever already," said Beatrice. "What fun it all is. I'm so glad you decided to do this again, Maxim."
"You've got her to thank for it," said Maxim, nodding at me.
"Oh, it's not true," I said. "It was all the fault of Lady Crowan."
"Nonsense," said Maxim, smiling at me. "You know you're as excited as a child at its first party."
"I'm not."
"I'm longing to see your dress," said Beatrice.
"It's nothing out of the way. Really it's not," I insisted. "Mrs. De Winter says we shan't know her," said Frank. Everybody looked at me and smiled. I felt pleased and flushed and rather happy. People were being nice. They were all so friendly. It was suddenly fun, the thought of the dance, and that I was to be the hostess. The dance was being given for me in my honour, because I was the bride. I sat on the table in the library swinging my legs, while the rest of them stood round, and I had a longing to go upstairs and put on my dress, try the wig in front of the looking-glass, turn this way and that before the long mirror on the wall. It was new, this sudden unexpected sensation of being important, of having Giles and Beatrice and Frank and Maxim all looking at me and talking about my dress. All wondering what I was going to wear. I thought of the soft white dress in its folds of tissue paper, and how it would hide my flat, dull figure, my rather sloping shoulders. I thought of my own lank hair covered by the sleek and gleaming curls. "What's the time?" I said carelessly, yawning a little, pretending I did not care. "I wonder if we ought to think about going upstairs." As we crossed the great hall on the way to our rooms, I realized for the first time how the house lent itself to the occasion, and how beautiful the rooms were looking. Even the drawing-room, formal and cold to my consideration when we were alone, was a blaze of colour now, flowers in every corner, red roses in silver bowls on the white cloth of the supper-table, the long windows open to the terrace, where, as soon as it was dusk, the fairy lights would shine. The band had stacked their instruments ready in the minstrels' gallery above the hall, and the hall itself wore a strange waiting air. There was a warmth about it I had never known before, due to the night itself, so still and clear, to the flowers beneath the pictures, to our own laughter as we hovered on the wide stone stairs. The old austerity had gone. Manderley had come alive in a fashion I would not have believed possible. It was not the still, quiet Manderley I knew. There was a certain significance about it now that had not been before, a reckless air, rather triumphant, rather pleasing. It was as if the house remembered other days, long, long ago, when the hall was a banqueting hall indeed, with weapons and tapestry hanging upon the walls, and men sat at a long, narrow table in the centre, laughing louder than we laughed now, calling for wine, for song, throwing great pieces of meat upon the flags to the slumbering dogs. Later, in other years, it would still be gay, but with a certain grace and dignity. And Caroline de Winter, whom I should represent tonight, would walk down the wide stone stairs in her white dress to dance the minuet. I wished we could sweep away the years and see her. I wish we did not have to degrade the house with our modern jig tunes, so out of place and unromantic. They would not suit Manderley. I found myself in sudden agreement with Mrs. Danvers. We should have made it a period ball, not the hotchpotch of humanity it was bound to be, with Giles, poor fellow, well-meaning and hearty in his guise of Arabian sheikh. I found Clarice waiting for me in my bedroom, her round face scarlet with excitement. We giggled at one another like schoolgirls, and I bade her lock my door. There was much sound of tissue paper, rustling and mysterious. We spoke to one another softly like conspirators. We walked on tiptoe. I felt like a child again on the eve of Christmas. This padding to and fro in my room with bare feet, the little furtive bursts of laughter, the stifled exclamations, reminded me of hanging up my stocking long ago. Maxim was safe in his dressing-room, and the way through was barred against him. Clarice alone was my ally and favoured friend. The dress fitted perfectly. I stood still, hardly able to restrain my impatience, while Clarice hooked me up with fumbling fingers. "Oh, it's handsome, madam," she kept saying, leaning back on her heels to look at me. "It's a dress fit for the Queen of England." "What about under the left shoulder there?" I said anxiously. "That strap of mine, is it going to show?" "No, madam, nothing shows." "How is it? How do I look?" I did not wait for her answer. I twisted and turned in front of the mirror. I frowned. I smiled. I felt different already, no longer hampered by my appearance. My own dull personality was submerged at last. "Give me the wig," I said excitedly. "Careful, don't crush it. The curls mustn't be flat. They're supposed to stand out from the face." Clarice stood behind my shoulder. I saw her round face beyond mine in the reflection of the looking-glass, her eyes shining, her mouth a little open. I brushed my own hair sleek behind my ears. I took hold of the soft, gleaming curls with trembling fingers, laughing under my breath, looking up at Clarice. "Oh, Clarice," I said,
What will Mr. de Winter say? I covered my own mousy hair with the curled wig, trying to hide my triumph, trying to hide my smile. Somebody came and hammered on the door. "Who's there?" I called in panic. "You can't come in." "It's me, my dear. Don't alarm yourself," said Beatrice. "How far have you got? I want to look at you." "No, no," I said. "You can't come in. I'm not ready." The flustered Clarice stood beside me, her hand full of hairpins, while I took them from her one by one, controlling the curls that had become fluffed in the box. "I'll come down when I'm ready," I called. "Go on down, all of you. Don't wait for me. Tell Maxim he can't come in."
"Maxim's down," she said. "He came along to us. He said he'd hammered on your bathroom door, and you never answered. Don't be too long, my dear. We're all so intrigued. Are you sure you don't want any help?"
"No," I shouted impatiently, losing my head. "Go away. Go on down." Why did she have to come and bother just at this moment? It fussed me. I did not know what I was doing. I jabbed with a hairpin, flattening it against a curl. I heard no more from Beatrice. She must have gone along the passage. I wondered if she was happy in her eastern robes, and if Giles had succeeded in painting his face. How absurd it was, the whole thing. Why did we do it, I wonder? Why were we such children? I did not recognize the face that stared at me in the glass. The eyes were larger, surely, the mouth narrower, the skin white and clear. The curls stood away from the head in a little cloud. I watched this self that was not me at all, and then smiled, a new, slow smile. "Oh, Clarice," I said. "Oh, Clarice." I took the skirt of my dress in my hands and curtsied to her, the flounces sweeping the ground. She giggled excitedly, rather embarrassed, flushed, though, very pleased. I paraded up and down in front of my glass, watching my reflection. "Unlock the door," I said. "I'm going down. Run ahead and see if they're there." She obeyed me, still giggling, and I lifted my skirts off the ground and followed her along the corridor. She looked back at me and beckoned.
"They've gone down," she whispered, "Mr. de Winter and Major and Mrs. Lacey. Mr. Crawley has just come. They're all standing in the hall."
I peered through the archway at the head of the big staircase and looked down on the hall below. Yes, there they were. Giles in his white Arab dress, laughing loudly, showing the knife at his side. Beatrice swathed in an extraordinary green garment and hung about the neck with trailing beads. Poor Frank, self-conscious and slightly foolish in his striped jersey and sea boots. Maxim, the only normal one of the party, in his evening clothes.
"I don't know what she's doing," he said. "She's been up in her bedroom for hours. What's the time, Frank? The dinner crowd will be upon us before we know where we are."
The band were changed, and in the gallery already. One of the men was tuning his fiddle. He played a scale softly, and then plucked at a string. The light shone on the picture of Caroline de Winter. Yes, the dress had been copied exactly from my sketch of the portrait. The puffed sleeve, the sash and the ribbon, the wide floppy hat I held in my hand, and my curls were her curls. They stood out from my face as hers did in the picture. I don't think I have ever felt so excited before, so happy and so proud. I waved my hand at the man with the fiddle and then put my finger to my lips for silence. He smiled and bowed. He came across the gallery to the archway where I stood.
"Make the drummer announce me," I whispered. "Make him beat the drum, you know how they do, and then call out Miss Caroline de Winter. I want to surprise them below."
He nodded his head. He understood. My heart fluttered absurdly, and my cheeks were burning. What fun it was! What mad, ridiculous, childish fun! I smiled at Clarice, still crouching on the corridor. I picked up my skirt in my hands. Then the sound of the drum echoed in the great hall, startling me for a moment, who had waited for it, who knew that it would come. I saw them look up, surprised and bewildered, from the hall below.
"Miss Caroline de Winter," shouted the drummer.
I came forward to the head of the stairs and stood there, smiling, my hat in my hand, like the girl in the picture. I waited for the clapping and laughter that would follow as I walked slowly down the stairs.
Nobody clapped. Nobody moved. They all stared at me like dumb things. Beatrice uttered a little cry and put her hand to her mouth. I went on smiling. I put one hand on the banister. "How do you do, Mr. de Winter?" I said. Maxim had not moved. He stared up at me, his glass in his hand. There was no colour in his face. It was ashen white. I saw Frank go to him as though he would speak, but Maxim shook him off. I hesitated, one foot already on the stairs. Something was wrong. They had not understood. Why was Maxim looking like that? Why did they all stand like dummies, like people in a trance? Then Maxim moved forward to the stairs, his eyes never leaving my face.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" he asked. His eyes blazed in anger. His face was still ashen white.
I could not move. I went on standing there, my hand on the banister. "It's the picture," I said, terrified at his eyes, at his voice. "It's the picture, the one in the gallery." There was a long silence. We went on staring at each other. Nobody moved in the hall. I swallowed. My hand moved my throat. "What is it?" I said. "What have I done?" If only they would not stare at me like that, with dull, blank faces. If only somebody would say something. When Maxim spoke again, I did not recognize his voice. It was still and quiet, icy cold. Not a voice I knew.
"Go and change," he said. "It does not matter what you put on. Find an ordinary evening frock. Anything will do. Go now, before anybody comes."
I could not speak. I went on staring at him. His eyes were the only living things in the white mask of his face.
"What are you standing there for?" he said, his voice harsh and queer. "Didn't you hear what I said?"
I turned and ran blindly through the archway to the corridors beyond. I caught a glimpse of the astonished face of the drummer who had announced me. I brushed past him, stumbling, not looking where I went. Tears blinded my eyes. I did not know what was happening. Clarice had gone. The corridor was deserted. I looked about me, stunned and stupid, like a haunted thing. Then I saw that the door leading to the west wing was open wide, and that someone was standing there. It was Mrs. Danvers. I shall never forget the expression on her face. Loathsome. Triumphant. The face of an exulting devil. She stood there, smiling at me. And then I ran from her, down the long, narrow passage to my own room, tripping, stumbling over the flounces of my dress.
Chapter 17. Clarice was waiting for me in my bedroom. She looked pale and scared. As soon as she saw me, she burst into tears. I did not say anything. I began tearing at the hooks of my dress, ripping the stuff. I could not manage them properly, and Clarice came to help me, still crying noisily. "It's all right, Clarice. It's not your fault," I said, and she shook her head, the tears still running down her cheeks. "Your lovely dress, madam," she said. "Your lovely white dress." "It doesn't matter," I said. "Can't you find the hook? There it is, at the back, and another one somewhere, just below." She fumbled with the hooks, her hands trembling, making worse trouble with it than I did myself, and all the time catching at her breath. "What will you wear instead, madam?" she said. "I don't know," I said. "I don't know." She had managed to unfasten the hooks, and I struggled out of the dress. "I think I'd rather like to be alone, Clarice," I said. "Would you be a dear and leave me? Don't worry, I shall manage all right. Forget what's happened. I want you to enjoy the party." "Can't I press out a dress for you, madam?" she said, looking up at me with swollen, streaming eyes. "It won't take me a moment." "No," I said, "don't bother. I'd rather you went, and Clarice—" "Yes, madam. Don't say anything about what's just happened." "No, madam." She burst into another torrent of weeping. "Don't let the others see you like that," I said. "Go to your bedroom and do something to your face. There's nothing to cry about, nothing at all." Somebody knocked on the door. Clarice threw me a quick, frightened glance. "Who is it?" I said.
The door opened and Beatrice came into the room. She came to me at once, a strange, rather ludicrous figure in her eastern drapery, the bangles jangling on her wrists. "My dear," she said, "my dear," and held out her hands to me. Clarice slipped out of the room. I felt tired suddenly and unable to cope. I went and sat down on the bed. I put my hand up to my head and took off the curled wig. Beatrice stood watching me. "Are you all right?" she said. "You look very white." "It's the light," I said. "It never gives one any colour." "Sit down for a few minutes and you'll be all right," she said. "Wait, I'll get a glass of water." She went into the bathroom, her bangles jangling with every movement, and then she came back, the glass of water in her hands. I drank some to please her, not wanting it a bit. It tasted warm from the tap. She had not let it run. "Of course I knew at once it was just a terrible mistake," she said. "You could not possibly have known. Why should you?"
"Known what?" I said.
"Why, the dress, you poor dear. The picture you copied of the girl in the gallery. It was what Rebecca did at the last fancy dress ball at Manderley. Identical. The same picture, the same dress. You stood there on the stairs, and for one ghastly moment I thought—"
She did not go on with her sentence. She patted me on the shoulder.
"You poor child, how wretchedly unfortunate. How were you to know?"
"I ought to have known," I said stupidly, staring at her, too stunned to understand. "I ought to have known."
"Nonsense! How could you know? It was not the sort of thing that could possibly enter any of our heads. Only it was such a shock, you see. We none of us expected it, and Maxim—"
"Yes, Maxim," I said.
"Well, he thinks, you see, it was deliberate on your part. You had some bet that you would startle him, didn't you? Some foolish joke, and of course he doesn't understand. It was such a frightful shock for him. I told him at once you could not have done such a thing, and that it was sheer appalling luck that you had chosen that particular picture."
"I ought to have known," I repeated again. "It's all my fault. I ought to have seen. I ought to have known."
"No, no, don't worry. You'll be able to explain the whole thing to him quietly. Everything will be quite all right. The first lot of people were arriving just as I came upstairs to you. They're having drinks. Everything's all right. I've told Frank and Giles to make up a story about your dress not fitting, and you're very disappointed."
I went on sitting on the bed with my hands in my lap.
"What can you wear instead?" said Beatrice, going to my wardrobe and flinging open the doors. "Here, what's this blue? Looks charming. Put this on. Nobody will mind. Quick, I'll help you."
"No," I said. "No, I'm not coming down." Beatrice stared at me in great distress, my blue frock over her arm.
"But, my dear, you must," she said in dismay. "You can't possibly not appear."
"No, Beatrice, I'm not coming down. I can't face them. Not after what's happened."
"But nobody will know about the dress," she said. "Frank and Giles will never breathe a word. We've got the story all arranged. The shop sent the wrong dress, and it did not fit, so you're wearing an ordinary evening dress instead. Everyone will think it perfectly natural. It won't make any difference to the evening."
"You don't understand," I said. "I don't care about the dress. It's not that at all. It's what has happened, what I did. I can't come down now, Beatrice, I can't."
"But, my dear, Giles and Frank understand perfectly. They're full of sympathy. And Maxim, too. It was just the first shock. I'll try and get him alone a minute. I'll explain the whole thing."
"No," I said. "No." She put my blue frock down beside me on the bed.
"Everyone will be arriving," she said, very worried, very upset. "It would look so extraordinary if you don't come down. I can't say you've suddenly got a headache."
"Why not?" I said wearily. "What does it matter? Make anything up. Nobody will mind. They don't any of them know me."
"Come now, my dear," she said, patting my hand. "Try and make the effort. Put on this charming blue. Think of Maxim. You must come down for his sake."
"I'm thinking about Maxim all the time," I said.
"Well then, surely—"
"No," I said, tearing at my nails, rocking backwards and forwards on the bed. "I can't. I can't." Somebody else knocked on the door.
"Oh dear, who on earth is that?" said Beatrice, walking to the door. "What is it?"
She opened the door. Giles was standing just outside.
"Everyone has turned up. Maxim sent me up to find out what's happening," he said. "She says she won't come down," said Beatrice. "What on earth are we going to say?"
I caught sight of Giles peering at me through the open door.
"Oh, Lord, what a frightful mix-up," he whispered.
He turned away embarrassed when he noticed that I had seen him.
"What shall I say to Maxim?" he asked Beatrice. "It's 8:05 now." "Say she's feeling rather faint, but will try and come down later. Tell them not to wait dinner.
I'll be down directly. I'll make it all right.
Yes, right you are.
He half-glanced in my direction again, sympathetic but rather curious, wondering why I sat there on the bed, and his voice was low, as it might be after an accident, when people are waiting for the doctor.
"Is there anything else I can do?" he said.
"No," said Beatrice. "Go down now. I'll follow in a minute." He obeyed her, shuffling away in his Arabian robes. This is the sort of moment, I thought, that I shall laugh at years afterwards, that I shall say, "Do you remember how Giles was dressed as an Arab, and Beatrice had a veil over her face and jangling bangles on her wrist?" And time will mellow it, make it a moment for laughter. But now it was not funny. Now I did not laugh. It was not the future, it was the present. It was too vivid and too real. I sat on the bed, plucking at the eiderdown, pulling a little feather out of the slit in one corner. "Would you like some brandy?" said Beatrice, making a last effort. "I know it's only Dutch courage, but it sometimes works wonders." "No," I said. "No, I don't want anything."
"I shall have to go down. Giles says they're waiting dinner. Are you sure it's all right for me to leave you?"
"Yes." "And thank you, Beatrice."
"Oh, my dear, don't thank me. I wish I could do something."
She stooped swiftly to my looking-glass and dabbed her face with powder.
"God, what a sight I look," she said. "This damn veil is crooked, I know. However, can't be helped."
She rustled out of the room, closing the door behind her. I felt I had forfeited her sympathy by my refusal to go down. I had shown the white feather. She had not understood. She belonged to another breed of men and women, another race than I. They had guts, the women of her race. They were not like me. If it had been Beatrice who had done this thing instead of me, she would have put on her other dress and gone down again to welcome her guests. She would have stood by Giles's side and shaken hands with people, a smile on her face. I could not do that. I had not the pride. I had not the guts. I was badly bred. I kept seeing Maxim's eyes blazing in his white face, and behind him Giles and Beatrice and Frank, standing like dummies, staring at me. I got up from my bed and went and looked out of the window. The gardeners were going round to the lights in the rose garden, testing them to see if they all worked. The sky was pale, with a few salmon clouds of evening streaking to the west. When it was dusk, the lamps would all be lit. There were tables and chairs in the rose garden for the couples who wanted to sit out. I could smell the roses from my window. The men were talking to one another and laughing.
"There's one here gone," I heard a voice call out. "Can you get me another small bulb? One of the blue ones, Bill?"
He fixed the light into position. He whistled a popular tune of the moment with easy confidence, and I thought how tonight, perhaps, the band would play the same tune in the minstrel's gallery above the hall.
"That's got it," said the man, switching the light on and off. "They're all right here. No others gone. We'd better have a look at those on the terrace."
They went off round the corner of the house, still whistling the song. I wished I could be the man. Later in the evening he would stand with his friend in the drive and watch the cars drive up to the house, his hands in his pockets, his cap on the back of his head. He would stand in a crowd with other people from the estate, and then drink cider at the long table arranged for them in one corner of the terrace.
"Like the old days, isn't it?" he would say.
But his friend would shake his head, puffing at his pipe.
"This new one's not like our Mrs. De Winter. She's different altogether." And a woman next them in the crowd would agree, other people too, all saying, "That's right," and nodding their heads.
"Where is she tonight? She's not been on the terrace once."
"I can't say, I'm sure. I've not seen her. Mrs. De Winter used to be here, there and everywhere." "Aye, that's right."
And the woman would turn to her neighbours, nodding mysteriously.
"They say she's not appearing tonight at all."
"Go on."
"That's right. One of the servants from the house told me Mrs. De Winter hasn't come down from her room all evening."
"What's wrong with the maid? Is she bad?"
"No, sulky, I reckon. They say her dress didn't please her."
A squeal of laughter, and a murmur from the little crowd.
"Did you ever hear of such a thing? It's a shame for Mr. De Winter.
I wouldn't stand for it, not from a chit like her."
"Maybe it's not true at all."
"It's true, all right. They're full of it up at the house."
One to the other, this one to the next. A smile, a wink, a shrug of the shoulder. One group and then another group, and then spreading to the guests who walked on the terrace and strolled across the lawns, the couple who in 3 hours' time would sit in those chairs beneath me in the rose garden.
Do you suppose it's true what I heard?
What did you hear?
Why, that there's nothing wrong with her at all. They've had a colossal row and she won't appear.
I say, a lift of the eyebrows, a long whistle.
I know. Well, it does look rather odd, don't you think? What I mean is, people don't suddenly for no reason have violent headaches. I call the whole thing jolly fishy.
I thought he looked a bit grim.
So did I.
Of course, I have heard before the marriage is not a wild success.
Oh, really?
Several people have said so. They say he's beginning to realise he's made a big mistake. She's nothing to look at, you know.
No, I've heard there's nothing much to her. Who was she?
Oh, no one at all. Some pick-up in the south of France, a nursery garve or something.
Good Lord!
I know. And when you think of Rebecca...
I went on staring at the empty chairs. The salmon sky had turned to grey. Above my head was the evening star. In the woods beyond the rose garden, the birds were making their last little rustling noises before nightfall. A lone gull flew across the sky. I went away from the window, back to the bed again. I picked up the white dress I had left on the floor and put it back in the box with the tissue paper. I put the wig back in its box, too. Then I looked in one of my cupboards for the little portable iron I used to have in Monte Carlo for Mrs. Van Hopper's dresses. It was lying at the back of a shelf with some woolen jumpers I had not worn for a long time. The iron was one of those universal kinds that go on any voltage, and I fitted it to the plug in the wall. I began to iron the blue dress that Beatrice had taken from the wardrobe, slowly, methodically, as I used to iron Mrs. Van Hopper's dresses in Monte Carlo. When I had finished, I laid the dress ready on the bed. Then I cleaned the makeup off my face that I had put on for the fancy dress. I combed my hair and washed my hands. I put on the blue dress and the shoes that went with it. I might have been my old self again, going down to the lounge of the hotel with Mrs. Van Hopper. I opened the door of my room and went along the corridor. Everything was still and silent. There might not have been a party at all. I tiptoed to the end of the passage and turned the corner. The door to the west wing was closed. There was no sound of anything at all. When I came to the archway by the gallery and the staircase, I heard the murmur and hum of conversation coming from the dining room. They were still having dinner. The great hall was deserted. There was nobody in the gallery either. The band must be having their dinner too. I did not know what arrangements had been made for them. Frank had done it. Frank... or Mrs. Danvers. From where I stood, I could see the picture of Caroline de Winter facing me in the gallery. I could see the curls framing her face, and I could see the smile on her lips. I remembered the bishop's wife who had said to me that day I called. I shall never forget her, dressed all in white, with that cloud of dark hair. I ought to have remembered that. I ought to have known. How queer the instruments looked in the gallery, the little stands for the music, the big drum. One of the men had left his handkerchief on a chair. I leant over the rail and looked down at the hall below. Soon it would be filled with people, like the bishop's wife had said, and Maxim would stand at the bottom of the stairs, shaking hands with them as they came into the hall. The sound of their voices would echo to the ceiling, and then the band would play from the gallery where I was leaning now, the man with the violin smiling, swaying to the music. It would not be quiet like this any more. A board creaked in the gallery. I swung round, looking at the gallery behind me. There was nobody there. The gallery was empty, just as it had been before. A current of air blew in my face, though. Somebody must have left a window open in one of the passages. The hum of voices continued in the dining room. I wondered why the board creaked when I had not moved at all. The warmth of the night, perhaps. A swelling somewhere in the old wood. The draught still blew in my face, though. A piece of music on one of the stands fluttered to the floor. I looked towards the archway above the stairs. The draught was coming from there. I went beneath the arch again, and when I came out onto the long corridor, I saw that the door to the west wing had blown open and swung back against the wall. It was dark in the west passage. None of the lights had been turned on. I could feel the wind blowing on my face from an open window. I fumbled for a switch on the wall and could not find one. I could see the window in an angle of the passage, the curtain blowing softly, backwards and forwards. The grey evening light cast queer shadows on the floor. The sound of the sea came to me through the open window.
the soft hissing sound of the ebb tide leaving the shingle. I did not go and shut the window. I stood there shivering a moment in my thin dress, listening to the sea as it sighed and left the shore. Then I turned quickly and shut the door of the west wing behind me, and came out again through the archway by the stairs. The murmur of voices had swollen now and was louder than before. The door of the dining room was open. They were coming out of dinner. I could see Robert standing by the open door, and there was a scraping of chairs, a babble of conversation and laughter. I walked slowly down the stairs to meet them. When I look back at my first party at Manderley, my first and my last, I can remember little isolated things standing alone out of the vast black canvas of the evening. The background was hazy, a sea of dim faces, none of whom I knew, and there was the slow drone of the band harping out a waltz that never finished, that went on and on. The same couple swung by in rotation with the same fixed smiles, and to me, standing with Maxim at the bottom of the stairs to welcome the latecomers, these dancing couples seemed like marionettes twisting and turning on a piece of string held by some invisible hand. There was a woman. I never knew her name, never saw her again, but she wore a salmon-coloured gown hooped in crinoline form, a vague gesture to some past century, but whether 17th, 18th, or 19th, I could not tell. And every time she passed me, it coincided with a sweeping bar of the waltz, to which she dipped and swayed, smiling as she did so in my direction. It happened again and again, until it became automatic, a matter of routine, like those promenades on board ship, when we meet the same people bent on exercise like ourselves, and know with deadly certainty that we will pass them by the bridge. I can see her now. The prominent teeth, the gay spot of rouge, placed high upon her cheekbones, and her smile, vacant, happy, enjoying her evening. Later I saw her by the supper table, her keen eyes searching the food, and she heaped a plate high with salmon and lobster mayonnaise, and went off into a corner. There was Lady Crowan, too, monstrous in purple, disguised as I know not what romantic figure of the past. It might have been Marie Antoinette or Nell Gwynn, for all I knew, or a strange erotic combination of the two. And she kept exclaiming in excited, high-pitched tones, a little higher than usual because of the champagne she had consumed, "You all have me to thank for this, not the De Winters at all." I remember Robert dropping a tray of ices, and the expression of Frith's face when he saw Robert was the culprit and not one of the minions hired for the occasion. I wanted to go to Robert and stand beside him and say, "I know how you feel. I understand. I've done worse than you tonight." I can feel now the stiff, set smile on my face that did not match the misery in my eyes. I can see Beatrice, dear, friendly, tactless Beatrice, watching me from her partner's arms, nodding encouragement, the bangles jangling on her wrists, the veil slipping continually from her overheated forehead. I can picture myself once more, whirled round the room in a desperate dance with Giles, who, with dog-like sympathy and kind heart, would take no refusal, but must steer me through the stamping crowd, as he would one of his own horses at a meet. "That's a jolly pretty dress you're wearing," I can hear him say. "It makes all these people look damn silly." And I blessed him for his pathetic, simple gesture of understanding and sincerity, thinking, "Dear Giles, that I was disappointed in my dress, that I was worrying about my appearance, that I cared." It was Frank who brought me a plate of chicken and ham that I could not eat, and Frank who stood by my elbow with a glass of champagne I would not drink. "I wish you would," he said quietly. "I think you need it." And I took three sips of it to please him. The black patch over his eye gave him a pale, odd appearance. It made him look older, different. There seemed to be lines on his face I had not seen before. He moved amongst the guests like another host, seeing to their comfort that they were supplied with drink and food and cigarettes. And he danced, too, in solemn, painstaking fashion, walking his partners round the room with a set face. He did not wear his pirate costume with abandon, and there was something rather tragic about the side whiskers he had fluffed under the scarlet handkerchief on his head.
I thought of him standing before the looking-glass in his bare bachelor bedroom, curling them round his fingers. Poor Frank. Dear Frank. I never asked. I never knew how much he hated the last fancy-dress ball given at Manderley. The band played on, and the swaying couples twisted like bobbing marionettes, to and fro, across the great hall and back again. And it was not I who watched them at all, not someone with feelings made of flesh and blood, but a dummy stick of a person in my stead, a prop who wore a smile screwed to its face. The figure who stood beside it was wooden, too. His face was a mask. His smile was not his own. The eyes were not the eyes of the man I loved, the man I knew. They looked through me and beyond me, cold, expressionless, to some place of pain and torture I could not enter, to some private inward hell I could not share. He never spoke to me. He never touched me. We stood beside one another, the host and the hostess, and we were not together. I watched his courtesy to his guests. He flung a word to one, a jest to another, a smile to a third, a call over his shoulder to a fourth, and no one but myself could know that every utterance he made, every movement, was automatic and the work of a machine. We were like two performers in a play, but we were divided. We were not acting with one another. We had to endure it alone. We had to put up this show, this miserable sham performance, for the sake of all these people I did not know and did not want to see again. "I hear your wife's frock never turned up in time," said someone with a mottled face and a sailor's pigtail, and he laughed and dug Maxim in the ribs. "Damn shame, what? I should sue the shop for fraud. Same thing happened to my wife's cousin once."
"Yes, it was unfortunate," said Maxim.
"I tell you what," said the sailor, turning to me, "you ought to say you are a forget-me-not. They're blue, aren't they? Jolly little flowers, forget-me-nots. That's right, isn't it, De Winter? Tell your wife she must call herself a forget-me-not."
He swept away, roaring with laughter, his partner in his arms.
"Pretty good idea, what? A forget-me-not."
Then Frank again, hovering just behind me, another glass in his hand. Lemonade this time.
"No, Frank, I'm not thirsty. Why don't you dance, or come and sit down a moment? There's a corner in the terrace. No, I'm better standing. I don't want to sit down. Can't I get you something? A sandwich? A peach? No, I don't want anything."
There was the salmon lady again. She forgot to smile at me this time. She was flushed after her supper. She kept looking up into her partner's face. He was very tall, very thin. He had a chin like a fiddle. The Destiny Waltz, the Blue Danube, the Merry Widow. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, round and round. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, round and round. The salmon lady. A green lady. Beatrice again, her veil pushed back off her forehead. Giles, his face streaming with perspiration. And that sailor once more with another partner. They stopped beside me. I did not know her. She was dressed as a Tudor woman. Any Tudor woman. She wore a ruffle round her throat and a black velvet dress.
"When are you coming to see us?" she said, as though we were old friends, and I answered, "Soon, of course. We were talking about it the other day, wondering why I found it so easy to lie suddenly. No effort at all. Such a delightful party. I do congratulate you," she said. "And thank you very much," I said. "It's fun, isn't it? I hear they sent you the wrong dress."
"Yes, absurd, wasn't it? These shops are all the same, no depending on them. But you look delightfully fresh in that pale blue, much more comfortable than this hot velvet. Don't forget, you must both come and dine at the palace soon."
"We should love to."
What did she mean? Where? What palace? Were we entertaining royalty? She swept on to the Blue Danube in the arms of the sailor, her velvet frock brushing the ground like a carpet sweeper. And it was not until long afterwards, in the middle of some night when I could not sleep, that I remembered the Tudor woman was the bishop's wife who liked walking in the Pennines. What was the time? I did not know. The evening dragged on, hour after hour, the same faces and the same tunes. Now and again the bridge people crept out of the library like hermits to watch the dancers, and then returned again.
Beatrice, her draperies trailing behind her, whispered in my ear,
"Why don't you sit down? You look like death."
"I'm all right." Giles, the make-up running on his face, poor fellow, and stifling in his Arab blanket, came up to me and said,
"Come and watch the fireworks on the terrace."
I remember standing on the terrace and staring up at the sky as the foolish rockets burst and fell. There was little Clarice in a corner with some boy off the estate. She was smiling happily, squealing with delight as a squib spluttered at her feet. She had forgotten her tears.
"Hello, this'll be a big un."
Giles, his large face upturned, his mouth open.
"Here she comes, bravo, jolly fine show."
The slow hiss of the rocket as it sped into the air, the burst of the explosion, the stream of little emerald stars, a murmur of approval from the crowd, cries of delight, and a clapping of hands. The salmon lady, well to the front, her face eager with expectation, a remark for every star that fell. "Oh, what a beauty! Look at that one now! I say, how pretty! That one didn't burst! Take care, it's coming our way! What are those men doing over there?" Even the hermits left their lair and came to join the dancers on the terrace. The lawns were black with people. The bursting stars shone on their upturned faces. Again and again the rockets sped into the air like arrows, and the sky became crimson and gold. Manderley stood out like an enchanted house, every window aflame, the grey walls coloured by the falling stars. A house bewitched, carved out of the dark woods. And when the last rocket burst and the cheering died away, the night, that had been fine before, seemed dull and heavy in contrast. The sky became a pall. The little groups on the lawns and in the drive broke up and scattered. The guests crowded the long windows in the terrace back to the drawing-room again. It was anticlimax. The aftermath had come. We stood about with blank faces. Someone gave me a glass of champagne. I heard the sound of cars starting up in the drive. "They're beginning to go," I thought. "Thank God, they're beginning to go." The salmon lady was having some more supper. It would take time yet to clear the hall. I saw Frank make a signal to the band. I stood in the doorway between the drawing-room and the hall, beside a man I did not know. "What a wonderful party it's been," he said. "Yes," I said. "I've enjoyed every minute of it," he said. "I'm so glad," I said. "Molly was wild with fury at missing it," he said. "Was she?" I said. The band began to play Auld Lang Syne. The man seized my hand and started swinging it up and down. "Here," he said. "Come on, some of you." Somebody else swung my other hand and more people joined us. We stood in a great circle, singing at the top of our voices. The man who had enjoyed his evening and said Molly would be wild at missing it was dressed as a Chinese mandarin, and his false nails got caught up in his sleeve as we swung our hands up and down. He roared with laughter. We all laughed. "Should old acquaintance be forgot," we sang. The hilarious gaiety changed swiftly at the closing bars, and the drummer rattled his sticks in the inevitable prelude to "God Save the King." The smiles left our faces as though wiped clean by a sponge. The mandarin sprang to attention, his hands stiff to his sides. I remember wondering vaguely if he was in the army. How queer he looked with his long poker face and his drooping mandarin moustache. I caught the salmon lady's eye. "God Save the King" had taken her unawares. She was still holding a plate, heaped with chicken in aspic. She held it stiffly out in front of her like a church collection. All animation had gone from her face. As the last note of "God Save the King" died away, she relaxed again and attacked her chicken in a sort of frenzy, chattering over her shoulder to her partner. Somebody came and wrung me by the hand. "Don't forget you're dining with us on the 14th of next month." "Oh, are we?" I stared at him blankly. "Yes, we've got your sister-in-law to promise, too." Oh, what fun. 8:30 and black tie. So looking forward to seeing you." Yes, rather." People began to form up in queues to say goodbye. Maxim was at the other side of the room. I put on my smile again, which had worn thin after Auld Lang Syne. "The best evening I've spent for a long time. I'm so glad. Many thanks for a grand party. I'm so glad. Here we are, you see, staying to the bitter end." "Yes, I'm so glad." Was there no other sentence in the English language?
I bowed and smiled like a dummy, my eyes searching for Maxim above their heads. He was caught up in a knot of people by the library. Beatrice, too.